This message comes from NPR sponsor Splunk, the data to everything platform, helping you turn data into successful outcomes for security, IT, DevOps, and, well, everything. Learn more about Splunk at splunk.com/D2E.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to How I Built This Resilience Edition. On these episodes, we're talking with entrepreneurs and other business leaders about how they're thinking creatively during this very disruptive moment. And today, my conversation with Song Laran, the co-founder of Squire. Squire is an app that connects barbershops with clients. Song founded Squire in 2016 with his best friend, Dave Salvant, to modernize the barbershop experience. And nowadays, their app is not only booking appointments, but also helping barbershops stay open, if they're allowed to. I spoke with Song a few days ago about Squire and the barbershop industry, but first, Song let me know that he actually wasn't at home.
I should mention that you are actually in an office of a barbershop right now in Connecticut, which you can hear a little bit of it behind you.
Can you hear it?
No, that's fine. That's fine. So first of all, are barbershops in Connecticut open?
Yes, they are. They are open. I think Connecticut is probably phase three or whatever phases where barbershops and other service-based businesses are open. So yeah, they're open for business.
And what's the protocol in there? Are the barbers wearing masks and the customers wearing masks?
Yeah, barbers wear masks, customers wear masks. There's no waiting in the barbershop anymore. Customers will have to wait outside or in their car until their appointment time is ready. And there's also, you know, social distancing between chairs. They spread out the chairs so that they're servicing less, you know, fewer customers as a result. I would say that barbers are probably one of the few types of professionals that are very well equipped in this new environment because they actually go to school for this. In order to get a barber license, you have to study, you know, disinfecting and taking different precautions. So, you know, unlike, you know, maybe waiters or other types of, you know, people who are providing services, I think barbers are one of the few that actually already had to get licensed and go through education, you know, to be prepared for this environment. So I'm a big proponent of barbershops reopening, needless to say.
Yeah. I'm in California and now barbershops are closed. And I have to be honest, like I would still be nervous about going. You know, I've given myself two very bad haircuts over the last 6 months with clippers and my kids too. But when you go now to a barbershop, what are they doing? Everyone's wearing a mask, but are they disinfecting the seats between customers and, you know?
Yeah, they're disinfecting. I mean, they already have to disinfect tools between every cut. They should be doing that. But now they're also disinfecting the seating area. Many of them are using disposable barber capes, or they're using just one per customer, so they'll have a supply, you know, ready so they're not reusing the capes.
Yep.
A lot of them are not doing certain services, like they won't do beard work or they won't do shaves, anything that would require the client to remove their mask. You know, I think that there hasn't been a lot of evidence of barbershops being one of the high transmission services.
Yeah.
But with anything, there's risks. There's risks. You know, walk outside any day and there's going to be some risk involved. And it's just a matter of, you know, the balance of how much you want that service. So it makes sense, you know, if you don't feel comfortable getting a haircut. Yeah.
There was this article, you probably saw it a couple days ago, of a hair salon where two of the stylists had tested positive for COVID, but none of the more than 130 customers that went in, you know, over the course of the few days tested positive. Everybody was wearing masks. Yep. And it sort of suggests that masks really do work.
Masks really do work, yeah. If there's one thing I wish everyone could kind of agree on, I think that, you know, we get masks work.
Yeah, can we just say that right now? Hey, all of those people who are on the hike that I went on over the weekend who were not wearing masks when you passed by me on the trail that was this wide, please wear a mask.
Please.
All right, let's talk brass tacks here, Song. So I mentioned a little bit about Squire. For people who don't know the app, tell us more about it.
Yeah, so Squire is a business management and point of sale software focusing on barbershops. So we do essentially everything that a barbershop needs to run their business, from handling the booking interface to the back end inventory. It's really customized specifically for the barbershop industry. And then on the consumer side, as a client, you can actually find a barbershop, book, pay, and tip all in the app or on the website.
And what's the business model? How do you guys make money through the business?
The main way is from handling the payment processing. So that's really core to our business. There's a subscription component. So the shops that use our platform will pay $100 to $250 a month. And then there's a customer booking fee. So if you book and pay on Squire, you'll pay about a dollar extra, and that revenue goes to Squire.
I mean, most people don't know this, but a lot of barbers are independent contractors. You may go to a barber shop and they may have a chair there, but they actually are their own business, right?
Yeah. So there's two central models for barbershop business models. One is what you mentioned, which we call kind of the booth rental model, where each barber is essentially an independent contractor. They run their own business. They manage their own schedule. They go and come as they please, and then they pay rent to the owner, usually on a weekly basis. And then the other model is what we call a commission model, where those barbers are treated a little bit more like employees. They have certain hours that they come, and in that case, they split the percentage of the transaction with the shop. Usually it'll be 60-40 or 50-50, and the owner will get a piece of every transaction.
You co-founded this with your friend Dave Salvant. Tell me how you guys had the idea. I mean, you studied philosophy as an undergraduate, and then you went and got a law degree, and Dave was an old friend, I guess. How did you guys come up with this idea?
Yeah, so I actually, prior to founding Squire, I was at a corporate law firm, and Dave was actually in business school, and both of us wanted to do something more entrepreneurial, didn't want to go the corporate route. So we would just brainstorm ideas on the weekend. And we eventually stumbled on the idea of barbershops. And the idea came out of our own experience. I haven't gone to barbershops for decades. Like most people, I started going with my dad as a kid around 6 or 7. And the experience of going to the barbershop hadn't changed. Very antiquated, low-tech industry, cash-based, need to call to make an appointment, long wait times. So all of those pain points that we had experienced formed the basis of why we came up with the idea of this is something that we wanted to work on.
Yeah. My barbershop, they don't take appointments. You have to get there when the doors open at 8:30, and they have a chalkboard, and there's usually a line, and it's cash only. It's $35, and you can get there at 8:30, and you might only get an appointment at like 11:45. And some days I'll like ride my bike down there at 8:30, and then they only have an appointment at a time where I have a live interview, and I can't get an appointment. I can't get a haircut. But basically, that's been the model for forever and ever for most barbershops.
Yeah, so and that's what we're solving, because that's not really an ideal experience for you as a customer, and it's not a good experience for the barbers either in terms of efficiently running their business. But getting a haircut is such a great experience, and it's such an important part of your life that you're willing to go through, that poor customer experience to get the service. But we think that we can make it better than that.
How do you approach barbershops? I mean, I have to imagine like there are a lot of barbershops that are like, I don't want to give up my cash, or I don't want to give up, you know, a percentage of my business or a percentage of my income. I mean, it's presumably you'd get some pushback from potential customers. So how do you make the case for people to sign up?
Yeah, I mean, the sell to them is that this is going to make their lives easier. This is going to save them time. And this is actually going to enable them to be better business owners and make more money. And we can show them that's what the software actually does. Early on, we did get more pushback from cash-only shops. So our focus was more on shops that are already taking cards, but that's really the trend just in the world generally. Consumers are used to paying for services with cards. So the shops that are cash only, there will be some segment that just doesn't want to pay taxes, quite frankly. But, you know, we're seeing more and more, particularly, you know, the newer shops that are opening, they understand that if they want to meet their consumers and provide a really great experience to their clients, that they have to kind of accept cards. And it enables them to charge more. You know, we know that it says people will pay more on card versus cash. And if you want to charge $30 a haircut, $40 a haircut, as is the case in many, many cities, it just makes sense.
I have to imagine that bookings are significantly down because there's so many states you can't go to a barbershop.
Yeah, so bookings definitely took a dip when the shutdowns started. March, April, you know, our revenue essentially went to zero.
Yep.
And we also decided to waive all of our subscription charges to current and new customers until October, because we knew that their revenue was also going to go to zero. We didn't want them to have that overhead. So as a result, you know, we expected Esquire essentially wouldn't be making any money, but we were okay with that because this is just such a difficult time. What we have seen, though, is that as shops, as our customers are reopening, they are getting booked out. They're getting booked out relatively fast, and then their bookings are continuing to stay consistent. You know, that just kind of speaks to how much of a need there was, like a pent-up demand from their clients to get haircuts. And I think that there's something about just the barbershop experience and the community element of it that people, you know, men in particular, really look forward to that normalcy and to being able to get a haircut and feel great about themselves and feel the way things were they were before COVID. So we're actually seeing it for the shops that are reopening higher than usual bookings. And, you know, we'll see how that trend continues in the months to come. So far, that's what we're seeing.
There's something I read that you had said about barbershops. You called them a fail-proof service, which I think is right. You know, I think you said, look, they bring in roughly half the population that needs grooming. But this pandemic, which nobody predicted and nobody anticipated, has shown that nothing is fail-proof. Everything can fail, even the most resilient ideas. So how have the past few months kind of made you rethink your business model?
It's made me understand that you can never predict the future. There's always going to be an unknown. We always thought that a recession was coming at some point.
Right.
You know, the gravy train can't go on forever. I always thought that our business would fare relatively well in a downturn, because, you know, people will continue to get haircuts. And we've seen this, you know, in the past, that these type of services, you know, tend to remain consistent in downturns. I mean, this is a total black swan event. I never would have predicted a pandemic at this scale. But if anything, this has made me believe that our business is even more resilient than I thought before. Just seeing how we've been able to kind of adapt to the reality and make changes on the fly, push features that we know our customers need during this time. And as a result, what we've seen in the last 2 months, actually more inbound and more customers signing up than we ever have in the life of the company.
When we come back in just a moment, we'll hear from Song about running a business during a global economic crisis and his plans for getting Squire through the pandemic. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This, Resilience Edition from NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
Hey, welcome back to How I Built This, Resilience Edition. Last month, Song Laran was able to raise some pretty significant venture capital, but he's taking extra precautions to make sure that this influx of cash will last Squire for the next few months. Song, I know you guys did a round that you raised more than $30 million during this crisis, but I have to imagine that you're trying to keep your cash balance sheet relatively strong and probably are cutting costs and trying to be fairly careful about how you spend cash in case this lasts a long time, right? You need that cash to last to get you through this economic crisis.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when we started seeing states reopening, it was a positive sign because our revenue started rebounding relatively quickly. In fact, May and June exceeded pre-COVID numbers just because of all the new business that we were bringing on. So that kind of showed, okay, things are trending toward best case. And then now we're seeing states closing again, which we didn't really expect, like California has reclosed. So it just goes to show you can never really know, but it's always safe to us kind of assume the worst case and be prepared for the worst case, which we were prepared to go to zero revenue for over 12 months.
Wow.
I thought that was in the realm of possibility.
Wow. We're getting a bunch of questions on Facebook from our audience. I want to ask a question from Dante Richardson. What are some principles that you've discovered and executed over the course of your entrepreneurial journey that have contributed to your success?
one of the principles is, I believe, in bringing the best people into your team and really looking for people that can complement your skill set and are better than you at what they do. And if you're an employee at a big company, a big corporation, you want to be the smartest guy or girl in the room. You want to excel over other employees so that you can kind of move up the ranks. And, you know, that's how you'll be successful. As a founder, you do not want to be the smartest person in the room.
Right.
You want people in the room who are way better than you at what they do so that collectively you can make the company excel. And that will, you know, in turn, make you successful as a founder. So kind of like a successful founder is only as successful as the people that they bring in. And also, I don't believe in micromanaging. I believe in bringing people in and giving them room, you know, to make mistakes, to excel, to learn from those mistakes. If you have to micromanage the people that you hire, you probably hired the wrong person. And so those are just two things off the top that I think are worthwhile.
I'm going to go to another question from our audience. It's from Claire Murashima. Hello, Claire. Claire asks, how have you kept your professional relationships during this time? I mean, with your team, with your co-founder, who's like one of your best friends, who's like across the country in LA. Have you been doing that and making sure that you keep morale up?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been a challenge to keep those relationships remotely. I mean, we have had a little bit of an advantage because we were already somewhat distributed. So, you know, we had an office in Buffalo, New York City. Our engineering team was all spread out. Our sales team was all spread out. So we were already used to collaborating on Zoom, you know, and communicating on Slack. But this took it to a whole new level because it just, there's no physical presence anymore. So, you know, we'll do like a virtual happy hour and not even talk about business. Things like that help. It's never a replacement for the physical, you know, one-to-one interaction, but it does help.
I want to ask you about, and you've written about this and tweeted about this, Black entrepreneurship in America has declined over the last 30 years. Also entrepreneurship full stop has. I mean, there were more Black-owned banks in the 80s and insurance companies in the 80s than there are today. If you were talking to like a young college graduate Black man or woman, and they were like, hey, should I become an entrepreneur today? Would you say now is a good time to start a business in this uncertain economic environment?
That's a tough question. That's a good question. I do think that the tides are changing, especially recently, with increased attention to the plight of Black founders and Black people in general. So I think that now is probably a better time than ever to be an entrepreneur, a Black entrepreneur. That being said, it's still, you know, going to be challenging to be an entrepreneur, period, let alone a Black entrepreneur. You know, the odds are kind of against you, you know, to be frank. So I would encourage them that if entrepreneurship is their dream and if that's kind of what they see themselves doing, then they have to pursue it. I always encourage people to take risks, but measured risks. So if you're at a big company and you're, you know, making a decent salary, save as much personal runway as you can before making the leap. Understand that you may go 6 months to 12 months with little to no income and just know what you're getting yourself into. But I do believe that entrepreneurship, particularly in tech, provides an opportunity for wealth creation that is in a short period of time that is really unparalleled in most other industries. I mean, I believe in it. I believe in entrepreneurship. You know, clearly that's what I've committed my life to, so I would never tell somebody to not pursue it, but it is risky, particularly now. Yeah.
You and Dave really launched your company after, before, but really were able to launch it with a grant that you received after entering into an entrepreneurship contest in Buffalo, New York. Has it been difficult over the years for the two of you to raise money?
It's been difficult. That company is called 43 North, and it actually wasn't a grant. It was an investment.
Investment, okay.
It was an investment, $650,000. We won the competition.
So that's an equity investment in your company.
It was an equity, yeah. It was actually structured as a warrant that converted to equity when we raised a price round. But prior to that, raising money is not easy, particularly at first. as a first-time entrepreneur, as somebody who doesn't have a track record in tech and didn't have the network at that point, it was challenging. We were fortunate, both my co-founder and I, to have a pretty decent network of professionals in New York City from like law, finance, and other kind of like high-paying industries. And we actually were able to get, and many of them are African-American, we were able to get some of our early like friends, no family, just friends around, friends and, slash angel that helped us, get to the next level. But for us, fundraising, until we raised the Series A and Series B, it was always a real kind of like just a grind, get one check that'll take us a couple months and then go out and try to get another. We never really stopped fundraising. It was a constant thing that we were doing to keep the business afloat. And quite a few times, we came close to, 1 month of runway.
Wow.
You're
running a business, you've got a staff of 60, you've got to show up and inspire people and be their leader. But also like you are a human and you were in New York in the midst of mass demonstrations against racial injustice, which I can't imagine was an incredibly emotional time for you and probably some people on your team. How did you guys navigate that and cope with that? Did you talk about it openly with each other? And were there days where you just didn't want to get on that Zoom call?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that kind of unfortunately you have to learn to do as an entrepreneur is compartmentalize. If something can be weighing on you that's outside of your business, you kind of have to learn how to put it in one place in your mind and focus on the things you have to focus, and then kind of give it attention when the time is right. Aside from everything that's going on in the world, just in life, that's kind of a skill set that many founders and entrepreneurs have learned that they have to develop. That was kind of my approach to it. It's like, if I were to stop working every time a black person was killed by the police, it would just be such a distraction. I would never be able to be successful. That's kind of like personally, on a personal level, what I've had to do. But as far as the company goes, we try to be very sensitive to our employees and what they're going through. We communicated to them that, as a company, we stand on the side of Black Lives Matter, of Black Lives Mattering. shouldn't even be a controversial statement. And that we really want to give our employees space to process. And we told everyone they could take time off if they needed to, if they wanted to just, be with their emotions, or if they wanted to go protest, or if they wanted to do whatever they wanted to do. We also made a statement as a company saying, our position and we made some public donations to some nonprofits. As a company, those are the things that we felt was the right thing to do. On an individual basis, as a black man, it's very difficult. On one side, you want to help, you want to do what you can to kind of support the movement. But on the other hand, you know that one of the most beneficial things you can do is create a successful company and be an example of what's possible and hopefully make it easier for black founders in the future to follow in your footsteps. So that's really, that's what I'm focused on.
Yeah. What do you want to take away with you from this moment? In 5 years' time, when you're running this company, which will be much bigger, and you look back at this moment, you say, I learned that then, and I'm so glad that we've carried it into what we do today. What would that thing be?
I think that I'm glad that we've remained, one, focused on this space, barbershops, and putting our customers first. That's one of our core values. Customers are our lifeblood. And I think that when this happened, nobody expected it. Nobody expected, pretty much all of our customers to be shut down and not operating. We had to make some decisions about what to do. And we optimized for doing what would provide the most value to them. So, we immediately switched focus to, how can we help these people during this time when they're not making money? How can we help them keep the doors open so that when the shutdown is over, they can reopen their doors? And I think that so far, it looks like those decisions were the right decisions, just because of the way, our customers in the market and the industry has reacted. And also, we're seeing, the features that we've rolled out actually really, helping them reopen successfully. So hopefully we'll look back and we'll say, we made the right decision, and Lord knows what crises await us in the future. But we're gonna have the same approach. You know, that will enable Squire to be successful. If we can make our customers successful, we'll be successful.
Yeah. Song, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
That's an excerpt from my conversation with Song Laran, the co-founder of Squire. To see our full interview, you can go to facebook.com/howibuiltthis. Just click on videos. And if you want to see all our past live interviews, you can also find them there or at youtube.com/NPR. If you want to find out more about the How I Built This Resilience series or other virtual NPR events, you can go to nprpresents.org. This episode was produced by Candace Lim with help from Ali Prescott, Al Mannion, Gianna Capadona, John Isabella, Julia Carney, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you back here in a few days. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This from NPR.